Very early last Tuesday morning, we arrived back in the United States from spending a better part of the summer in Africa. And just a few hours after arriving, received a telephone call from a reporter with the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. Talked to him for, well, I suppose, a half hour or longer. Sought, in the midst of jet lag and kind of sleepy and confused, to answer a multitude of questions, some of which were very complex and philosophical. And I told him, in the process of that interview, that after spending time in Africa and studying in preparation for going and just a million bits of input, I'm not sure that I have yet processed it all to the point that I really can understand and put in balance and perspective all that I've seen and learned. I feel kind of that way tonight. I'm not sure that all the impressions and ideas and things that I want to share with you are really quite coherent, that they all hang together and that I can adequately synthesize them. So with a bit of apology for any non-coherence in the beginning, let me explain to you what I'd like to do in our time together, both tonight and in the next couple of weeks. This evening I'd like to give to you an overview of what I see as a very complex situation in Black Africa. And then, not quite related to that, is to share with you a little bit of the experience that we had in Kenya, which I think grows out of the complexity of the situation in Africa today. And admittedly, what I'm going to say tonight is going to leave a rather pessimistic picture. And I would like to balance that out in the next couple of Sunday nights when we look at pictures and talk specifically about what God is doing against a rather difficult situation in Africa. Let me list for you a number of items which I see as very complex and overwhelming problems that are being faced by the continent of Africa and the nations that are there today. I've jotted down, let's see, about half a dozen of them. The first one is a booming population. Now, Africa, by comparison to India or China, is not a particularly densely populated area. There are only 362 million people in the continent of Africa, which would be slightly more than we have on the continent of North America, or I'm not quite even sure what the population of all of Central America and Mexico would be, maybe roughly equivalent. But keep in mind that there are large parts of Africa that are really not inhabitable in the sense that most of our country is. There are a lot of lands that are not suited for agriculture, and a major part of Africa is the Sahara Desert. But aside from the basic population of 362 million, far more significant is that the rate of population growth in the continent of Africa is the largest in the world. And at the present rate of growth, by the year 2000, which is now only 18 years away, it will nearly double to almost 646 million people, that is, by the turn of the century. Areas like northern Niger, where we were, is just desert, it's just sand. Other places like Rwanda, a little country that most people, unless you know missionaries there, have some special connection, perhaps have never even heard of, is the most densely populated country in all of Africa. 5 million people in 10,000 square miles, an area that's called the Mountains of the Moon, and essentially the entire country is mountainous, and yet completely covered with farms and populated areas. Kenya is a country that has the highest birth rate and population growth, percentage-wise, in all the world, growing at 3.9% per year. Now, add to that booming population in the continent of Africa political instability. Since 1960, in tribal wars, in invasions from other countries, and in civil wars, over 6 million people have died. 6 million people out of about 300 million. 6 million people, the total number of Jews that were killed under Hitler's regime in Nazi Germany. 6 million people because of political instability, tribal warfare, and invasion. A coup d'etat is nothing unusual in Africa. You take just the country of Ghana, which was the first African country to receive independence from its colonial overlords in 1957. Since 1957, there have been a half dozen, rather five, coups in Ghana alone. If you look at the continent of Africa today, right now, there are seven major conflicts or wars that are going on from Angola to Ethiopia. Seven major wars, many of which are wars like in Northern Ireland that really have no simple or easy solution to them. The nations of Africa, which are by almost anybody's standards, amongst the poorest in the world, spend $15 billion a year in military budgets alone. A decade ago, it was $2 billion. Now, start putting those pieces together. A booming population, inadequate resources to take care of them, and $15 billion being spent to subsidize armies to buy weapons to invade nations and kill one another. Political instability for a large number of the countries of Africa has become the norm. Milton Obote was the president of Uganda prior to the revolution when Idi Amin took over. And I talked to missionaries who were in Kampala under Obote, and they told about how delighted they were when Amin became the president of the country, and how people danced in the streets, how there was happiness amongst whites and blacks alike, until they began to realize that the difficulties that they had under Dr. Obote were far, far greater under Idi Amin. And then, when the country had reached, I guess, the nadir of its entire history, troops came in from Tanzania, they overthrew Idi Amin, he fled to an Arab country, and then Milton Obote, who was in Tanzania, came back in and took over once again. And Uganda, which really, by many standards, was one of the prizes of all of Africa, as far as advancement and stability and economy and everything else, is today a country that is just bordering on disaster. In Liberia, President Tolbert was ruling over a relatively stable government. We'll talk more about Liberia in a couple of weeks, but Liberia is a country that has never had a colonial overlord. It's a country that was established by the United States by freed slaves, and there's all kinds of complexities that go with that, but the country goes back far beyond most of the nations of Africa. 2 years ago, in 1980, some troops trained by American Green Berets ran 20 miles or so up the coast through the Elwa Mission Station along the beach there, up into Monrovia and into the presidential palace where they killed the president. Killed him because of the problems that were going on in the country of Liberia. Now, as one missionary explained to me, the people that were part of that coup, actually a small number of soldiers, apparently never really intended to overthrow the government. They simply intended to kill the president because they thought that he was at the root of all their problems. But once they had killed him, they faced an immediate dilemma. That was, they could either turn themselves in which case they'd be executed for assassinating the president, or else they had to take over the country and run it. So they chose to take over the country and run it, and Stephen Doe, a sergeant in the Liberian army, 28 years old, established himself as the commander-in-chief and now runs the country of Liberia. As someone in Abidjan, Ivory Coast said to me, there are a lot of sergeants that are left in Africa who could do the same thing and take over other countries that are there. In Kenya, the showcase of all of Africa, a stable government since independence for 19 years, a country that is essentially capitalistic in comparison to African socialism and many of the other countries of Black Africa, a country that has had not only peace and stability, but a high measure of prosperity. And yet it was there on August 1 of this year that an attempted coup shattered the possibility of even that one nation having a certainty of ongoing tranquility. Booming population, political instability, and then add a third ingredient to this, what I think is very complex picture, and that is economic disaster. Again, a lot of ingredients come together. Like most of the rest of the world, Africa is experiencing extremely rapid urbanization. People are moving out of the rural areas and into the cities. Abidjan, which is the capital of the Ivory Coast in West Africa, is a city of 1.7 million people. It's a beautiful city, a prosperous city, really, an amazing and great city. But Abidjan is growing at the rate of 100,000 people per year. And there are similar stories told all over Africa, where people are leaving tribal areas with all of their heritage and all of their ethnic background and language, and moving into cities with the hope of a better life. But the cities are simply not able to provide the services and the jobs and the food to sustain the population shift. If it were urbanization alone, or if that urbanization were occurring 10 years ago, perhaps it could be handled. But what we experience here in America as an economic recession is far greater in its impact in the rest of the world. Now, I know, because I've said it here many times, and I've thought and read a great deal about it, we're in the midst, obviously, of a
difficult time, economically and financially. There are people that would make comparisons between 1982 and what's happening in this recession to the crash and the depression of 1929 and 30 and 31. But what we have in America in comparison to what is happening in the economies of third world countries make everything that we've got, even as a problem, seem to be relatively good. There are declining markets. Countries like the United States and Britain and West Germany and Japan, because of the recession, are buying fewer and fewer goods and raw materials from third world countries. Third world countries in Africa and elsewhere that have already an extremely delicate balance of economy. And then to all of a sudden lose those sales, well, that would be like all of us having two-thirds or a third or a half cut in income and have it still continue to decline and yet have needs that stay either at the same level or increase. Let me give you some examples of the way it works. In the country of Zambia, the home country of one of our elders, Roy Cruz, throughout its recent history, 90% of its earnings of overseas money has been through the export of copper, 90% of its economy. That means that Zambia has been essentially 100% almost dependent upon copper in order for the country to have any earnings at all. In April of 1974, copper on the world market sold for $3,034 a ton. At the end of last year, in December of 1981, the world price of copper had dropped from that $3,034 a ton to $1,290 a ton. And yet 90% of Zambia's economy is dependent upon those sales in copper. Tanzania, a country that is going through unbelievable economic difficulty. I mean, it's so bad that in the capital of Dar es Salaam, they don't even sell fuel at the airport anymore. A commercial plane that comes in has to have enough fuel to take off after it leaves in order to go to the next place. And there are horror stories galore of what's happening in the country of Tanzania. In 1972, to give sort of a comparison, the country of Tanzania had to sell 38 tons of sisal in order to buy one truck. In order to buy one truck in 1982, it takes not 38 tons of sisal, but 138 tons of sisal. What that amounts to is the country can no longer import trucks, can no longer import parts, can no longer import food. Most of the countries in Africa that we visited, gasoline routinely sells for $3.50 to $4 a gallon. But keep in mind that people are earning $1.50 to $2 a day. We're in Mombasa in Kenya. A friend of the Paulsons, who are Wooddale missionaries there, a woman that lived with them and worked with them when they were in Uganda, came to visit them because their children were back from the States. And she came, I think, rather amazingly across the border from Kampala, Uganda, over to Nairobi and on down to Mombasa. And on Sunday morning a month ago, we sat around the breakfast table talking with her and asked her a little bit about what is happening to the economy in Uganda. And Mrs. Paulson asked her how much it would cost today in Kampala, in a market, to buy one loaf of bread in U.S. dollars. And her answer was $35 to buy one loaf of bread. Well, you know what the answer to that is. The answer is the same as it would be for you. You couldn't afford to buy a loaf of bread, even on your income. And obviously, the people in Kampala then can't afford, unless they're incredibly wealthy, and few are, to even buy bread. In the country of Kenya, there is a $1 billion per year shortage in foreign currency exchange. That means every year that country, a third world, relatively poor country, $400 per year per capita income, is $1 billion short. Now, the president of the country, Daniel Arap Moi, has taken very severe and strict measures in order to control the economy of the country. But let me explain to you the complexity of this. He has, for example, put on currency controls. So if you are a citizen of Kenya, you are allowed under law to take only $400 out of the country once every 3 years, which means that you're a prisoner in your country. You can't travel really overseas unless someone outside the country will buy a ticket for you and fund it. There are currency controls so that when you come through the Nairobi airport, you have to declare every dollar, every traveler's check, every bit of money that you have. You can't use a traveler's check to buy something in a shop in Nairobi. You can only exchange money at a bank or at a hotel that is licensed to do that. The exchange rate is about 10 Kenya shillings to a dollar. We had people, black market people, come up to us in the streets of Nairobi and offer us 50% more than that, 15 shillings to the dollar. Now, I thought that was a great way to make some extra money for the church, but since they told me that I'd probably end up spending some time in a Kenyan prison, I decided to forego that economic move. The point is that there's a lot of strict control. When you leave the country, you have to declare every shilling that you have. And for instance, we had a few, even though we were coming back into the country, we had a few more. Now we're talking here $30, and I think we had $35. They wouldn't let us leave the country until we exchanged that back into US dollars, because they have that tight a control over their money, because they don't want their money to leave the country because they have so relatively little of it. They've also put controls on the imports of raw materials, because if you import raw materials, you have to pay for them in US dollars or some other hard currency of the world. And since there's such a shortage of that, they have to restrict it. Charlene and I spent several hours one afternoon with a family that told just an incredible story. A man and woman who were born and raised in Kenya, born of European parents. His father and mother were Czechoslovakians, and about the time of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, they moved to Kenya and lived there most of their lives, so he was born and raised in Kenya. And she was from a Danish family that also, many years before she was born, moved to Kenya, and she also was born and raised there. So they have the interesting distinction of being whites who are natural Kenyan citizens. For a while, he was a pilot for East Africa Airlines when it was under the British, and when that airline was dissolved, he went into a manufacturing business of manufacturing fiberglass products. Some of those products were things like furniture, but the primary product that he made was fiberglass boats. Now, the material, the raw material for fiberglass, has to be imported from outside the country. But the country restricted the import of those types of raw materials. So as a result of that, it was impossible for him to import the raw materials that he needed. He had 330 workers in his factory. 330 workers that were therefore idled because they couldn't get the raw materials. But the law of Kenya, because there's such high unemployment, is that unless you have government permission, you can't lay off any of your employees. So for 9 months in his factory, he had 330 employees on full payroll that had absolutely nothing to do. After 9 months, he went bankrupt, and the country took over his business, and he went into receivership. Then the government pressed criminal charges against him for breach of contract in the boats that he failed to produce. And one of the boats that they said that he had failed to produce for one government agency had already been confiscated by another government agency, the Customs Department, and is being used in the Mombasa Harbor. So here's a guy caught in the trap. They have decided that they want to emigrate out of the country and immigrate into the United States. They've been able to get two of their children out of the country. His passport has been taken away. He's already spent some time in prison as a result of all of these controls that are there. At one point, he had his passport for 14 hours, and his only regret was that he didn't leave the country at that time to come to the United States. And he claims that if he can get his passport again, he's going to go immediately to the Nairobi airport and get the first flight out. Now, keep in mind that this is a man of pretty well-to-do means. But he can't take any of his money out of the country. He is going to leave behind his home. He is going to leave behind his cars. He is going to leave behind his life savings, everything he has, in order to come to the United States and start all over again in Arizona. Now, I in no way mean that as a demeaning story for Kenya, because I think the situation has some explanation and justification from their point of view. But as we sat around the table in that house in Nairobi with his wife crying over the situation, that, by the way, this has been going on now for over 6 months of waiting every day, not knowing when they're going to be arrested or get their passport or what's going to happen. She said, you know, you as an American really don't appreciate all that you have. She said, the difference between America and all the other countries of the world is not that you have prosperity and that you have money. The difference that you have is that your system is fair. You at least have a chance. You have a chance that you can go to court. You have a chance that you can plead your cause. You have a chance that right will win. And she said, in most of the world, and in her country, we don't have that chance. Now, I'm not one of those people that normally stands up and waves an American flag and any type of a chauvinistic nationalist. But I really believe that she's right, that we have a tremendous lack of appreciation for all that we have in our country, and perhaps a tremendous lack of understanding over the complexities and difficulties and hardships of other countries of the world. Booming population, political instability, economic disaster. Newsweek magazine says that most of the countries of Africa, excluding certainly countries like Libya and South Africa because of their different economic situation, but the countries of Black Africa are, for all practical purposes, bankrupt and either in disaster or on the verge of disaster economically. And that is to a large part related to the international recession and to a large part related to the economic policies of the United States. Add a fourth tremendous problem, and that is the perils to life that are common in the continent of Africa. There are great killers, killers that we really don't understand because they're not part of our society. Malaria. In the country of Zimbabwe, when the revolution took place there, they stopped spraying for mosquitoes, and there's an estimate of 250,000 people that contracted malaria almost immediately from mosquito bites that wouldn't otherwise have gotten it. Malaria, cholera, tuberculosis. Don't hear too much about tuberculosis in the United States. But Charlene and I visited a hospital in the south of Rwanda where there's a tuberculosis ward and where you can see all the beds and hear all the people coughing from that devastating disease. Typhoid, yellow fever, hepatitis, polio. When's the last time you heard about someone in the United States having polio? It was as a child that I received the Salk vaccine, but in order to travel to Africa, it was necessary to get an update on that, something that would probably is unheard of for any other adult that is here tonight unless you've traveled there. Sleeping sickness, diseases that I had never even heard of before that are common threats to people on an everyday basis. Many countries in Africa are tremendously short of doctors. When the colonial powers moved out, many of the doctors went out with them. Now, certainly there are exceptions. In the country of Ivory Coast, there are many French physicians. There's a fine medical school in Abidjan. But there are other countries, places where once there was medical care that is no longer adequate. In Ethiopia and in Zaire. Statistics say that 6 out of 10 of the black children of Africa go to bed hungry every night. We visited a hospital in a pediatric ward where we saw child after child desperately ill of malnutrition. Babies a few months old whose hair had turned white from a lack of protein, whose skin was like loose clothes on their bones. In Africa, there is the shortest life expectancy of anywhere in the world, 47 years. There are growing food shortages. Increasingly, the countries of Africa are dependent upon imports. There were 22 African nations in 1980 where there were severe famines. Countries like Tanzania and Kenya, where there used to be adequate food supplies, now have to depend upon imports. And at the rate of current population growth, most of the countries of Africa will not be able to feed themselves. One half of all the world's refugees are in the continent of Africa, 5 million of them. People, because of wars, because of famines, because of political uprisings, have to move from one border to another, and so they move across the continent looking for homes and looking for jobs and looking for food, but oftentimes ending up in horrible refugee camps where they find only death. Newsweek magazine estimates that by the year 2000, 40% of the food of Africa will need to be imported. Perils to life, disease, famine, and natural disasters. The advance of the Sahara Desert has sometimes been as much as several miles per year, in some areas as much as 30 miles per year. In Niger, most of the population is in the southern rim, in that sub-Sahara part of Niger. When we were in Niamey with Joanne Franz, a member of WIDDOW, whom many of you know, we found out the statistic that in the first 6 months, up until the time that we are in Niamey, Niger, the total rainfall for 1982 was 25 millimeters. That's about an inch. 1 inch of rain. I mean, you think there's been a dry summer in Minnesota. It's like flood compared to what's there. As a result of that, many of the people who have livestock and have subsistence farming are seeing their few crops die and are having to either kill their precious animals for meat or let them die of thirst and starvation. Booming population, political instability, economic disaster, perils to life. One more, and that is corruption. Again, we think in terms of corruption in our own country and government, and certainly it's there. But in many parts of Africa, corruption has become, with a great deal of difficulty for many of the people, a way of life. In the country of Kenya, we routinely saw roadblocks and had many people tell us that for black Africans it's a routine when you drive anywhere in the Nairobi area to be stopped perhaps as many as 4 or 5 times by a roadblock. You'll be taken by a police officer 10 or 20 yards down the road, and he expects to receive a bribe. And if you don't bribe him, then he will find some offense for which to ticket you. And you know, with your own automobile, if somebody checks long enough, they're going to find a cracked taillight, or your muffler is going to be too loud, or there's going to be something that is worthy of some type of a ticket. And so it's necessary for people to bribe a police officer perhaps as many as 4 or 5 times, just driving 30 or 35 miles in the Nairobi metropolitan area. Diplomats in the country of Tanzania tell about going to bed at night and leaving money out on the table downstairs, hoping that if and when the robbers come, that they'll be satisfied with the money that's left down there rather than coming upstairs. In the airports in Nigeria, missionaries say that if you don't bribe the officials just in going through customs and getting your passport stamped, that the delays will be such that you'll miss your flight. And so many missionaries in other parts of Africa are reluctant to go through the country of Nigeria at all because of the requirement of bribing official after official. Nigeria, by the way, the city of Lagos, is now rated as the most expensive city in all the world in which to live. Now, keep in mind that we're talking about people that are poor, and yet in Lagos, the average price to rent a car for 1 week is $650. The average motel room price in Lagos is $151 a night. If you go to a medium-quality restaurant, you can expect to pay about $41 per person per meal. Most of the missionaries and people that live in what we would call traditional Western houses have walls around and zomos, which is the Swahili word for guards. Many of the people have dogs, Dobermans, and German shepherds to protect them from robbers. Cars are, in many parts of Africa, routinely run off the road by robbers. And so missionaries can tell you stories, as can others in Africa, of driving along highways in Kenya and all of a sudden having a large car or truck come alongside you and smash into you time after time until you're over on the side of the road, at which point you're going to be robbed. Now, corruption like that has a frightening toll on the average person. It's tremendously discouraging. There's little hope of getting ahead. But it's, to a large extent, all the way through the society and through the government. In the country of Zaire, which is one of the most strained and interesting countries of Africa, President Mobutu, when he came to office, was a man of little, if any, means. And yet today, he has over $4 billion in Swiss bank accounts and extensive real estate holdings in the United States and Canada. When he made a trip to the United States, in 2 weeks, he spent $2 million just traveling around our country. And yet, the average wage of a worker in Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire, is $2 a day. There's a road just over the Zaire border from Rwanda. Well, there's a place where a road is supposed to be. A road estimated in cost at $20 million that has been paid for by foreign governments 3 times, but there's no road there, because the entire $20 million, or rather $60 million, by the time you get all 3 contributions put together, have been absorbed through corruption in Mobutu's government. The country of Zaire essentially operates on a black market as far as the economy is concerned, a tremendous ethical problem for missionaries that we'll talk about in another week. I was talking to a missionary who is the head of the Free Methodist Church mission in the country of Zaire. And I said to him, you know, when you hear about Mobutu and $4 million in Swiss bank accounts and you hear horror stories of political prisoners being put in awful jails and executed and things like that, what must people in Africa think when they hear that a president of the United States had to resign from office because some distant person in his government robbed or broke into a psychiatrist's office one night? They must think that that's rather strange. And this missionary said to me, oh, that isn't what they think is strange at all. What they think is strange is that Nixon is still alive. They just can't imagine that the country would get a president and depose him and not kill him. It's unimaginable that that not be done. Well, if this seems to be a terribly bleak picture, I think it is. The combination of booming population, political instability, economic disaster, perils to life, corruption, and government. And so it becomes then a tragic cycle, where all of these problems press down upon a society and a government and a country. And what would you do if you were the head of state or in a government where you had to face these problems? The greatest political geniuses in the world would be hard-pressed to make even a single step forward. And so even the best of leaders are hard put to come up with any kind of solution. And so many of them have submitted to the way of life and themselves become guilty of corruption. As a result, there becomes a growing discontent in the country. And then there is a revolution where some military officer thinks that he can put things right and blames the problems of the country on the president or the head of state. And if he is killed and there's a revolution, then the problems will be solved. And so there's an assassination, there's a coup d'etat, the government is overthrown, and new leadership comes in. But it doesn't take very long until those new leaders discover that the problems are for them also unsolvable. And then they, unable to solve the problems, many times themselves become equally guilty or more guilty of corruption. And then there are greater problems and then the potential of another revolution on top of that. You ask, is there any good news? Yes, there is. There is incredible good news. The amazing thing is that the Church of Jesus Christ is growing faster on the continent of Africa than anywhere else in the world. That of the 362 million people in Africa, 182 million of them, about half of them, claim to be Christians. And the Church of Jesus Christ is growing at the rate of 5 million per year. And at the current rate of growth, by the turn of the century, Africa will be by far the most Christian continent in the world. So there's this complexity, something that I try to struggle with and try to understand and try to define, of how there can be all of these problems and difficulties pressing in upon people, and yet also the Spirit of God moving in ways that really are parallel to what happened in the first century, in the first century church as it swept across the Roman Empire. Well, we're going to talk more about that in future weeks. Let me just tell you for several minutes a little bit about our experience. We left the Twin Cities here in the end of June, and I traveled out to California for our Board of Regents meeting for Bethel College and Seminary, and then we had a few days, just under a week, of family vacation together in New England, and then sent two of our children, Jill and Jeff, off to Florida to stay with my parents, and Greg and Brian stayed in New Jersey with Charlene's folks. We left on Friday, the 9th of July, from New York and went through Paris, just a couple of hours stop over there, and then on to Niamey, Niger. We're there with Joanne Franz, where it was fairly warm. Someone told us that the day that we left, it was 120 in the shade and 137 in the sun. Although, honestly, we were warmer this afternoon than it was there. There's something about the humidity in Minnesota that just makes it extra special. From there, there really isn't a whole lot of air transportation available from West Africa to East Africa, and so we went through a rather complex journey, changing planes in Abidjan, the Ivory Coast, which is in West Africa, and spent essentially 24 hours traveling across the continent and arrived in Nairobi, spent some time in Kenya, and after a week or so there, went on to what was the hub, and to me, by far the most exciting part of our trip, and that was 12 days in Rwanda, and again, I'll tell you more about this in another week, but a divine appointment with 200 missionaries that touched my heart and really was one of the highlight spiritual experiences of my entire life. After that, we were planning to go on to the Ivory Coast where the Swinburnes, who are Wooddale missionaries, are ministering. We planned to travel all the way by road up the country and then fly back to Abidjan and on to Liberia and back to the United States. In order to do that, to get out of Rwanda, a country that has relatively few flights going to only a few places, it was necessary to go back to Kenya. So on Saturday afternoon, we got a flight out of Kigali and into Nairobi and got in there just before midnight on the 31st of July. By the time we went through customs and declared currency and went through all the formalities, and got on a bus so that we could get into a hotel in Nairobi. Mind you, we're only planning to be there 14 hours. We're scheduled to leave at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon for a flight onto Abidjan in the Ivory Coast. We finally left the airport about 12:30 a.m. on Sunday morning. The attempted coup began at that airport at 2 a.m., an hour and a half after we left on Sunday morning. There were tourists there who were on a European jet that were stuck there for 36 hours on their plane. And you imagine the difficulty of that without food and without air conditioning and all the problems that they would have there. We got to the hotel about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we had been out of contact in areas where there was no communication at all for so long that we decided that we would attempt a transatlantic call back to the United States to find out if Wooddale was still here and our children were still alive, and I guess if our parents were still alive, maybe it would be a more fitting thing to check out. We were able to get a call through and talk for 8 minutes, and that was a very special thing. Got to bed then about 1:30 on Sunday morning. Just before dawn, about 6:30 in the morning, I heard these noises outside and sort of half asleep wondered what was going on, and increasingly awakening, realized that it was artillery shells exploding and rifle fire. I said to Charlene, this may be silly, but sounds like they're having a revolution out there. Now, you feel dumb saying something like that if it's not. So I qualified, and I know it was a silly thing to say. But then I turned on the radio that was between the beds in our room and heard just a lot of music and then voices that came over the music. And that was when we realized what was happening. There was an announcement that the corrupt and incapable government of President Daniel Arap Moi had been overthrown, that the Constitution had been set aside, that the National Assembly had been dissolved, that the country was now under the government of the National Redemption Council, that political prisoners were all being set free, that students at Kenyatta College and the University of Nairobi were invited to come out into the streets and demonstrate and celebrate the revolution, that the Kenyatta airport was closed and that all borders out of Kenya were closed. So we realized that it was the real thing. Then for a number of hours, we listened and tried to find out more news as the government and the rebels competed for control of the airwaves and made conflicting announcements. One of the more interesting announcements that was repeated on through the day. I have some tape recordings of this that I hope to play for you next Sunday night. They kept announcing, "Everything is all right. Everything is normal. Don't panic." And you could hear machine gun fire in the background. "Everything is normal. Don't panic. Don't panic." And the guys are obviously panicking, and they're talking to each other in the background. Well, in the streets then, we began to see what was happening. There were army trucks. There were soldiers. There were increasing sounds of gunfire. At first, there were a lot of civilians that were out in the streets, but increasingly, they were walking with their hands up. Whenever they would see a truck or a car that had officers in it, soldiers in it, they would hold up their hands to show that they did not have weapons. Increasingly, they walked through the streets holding up their identity cards to identify who they were. What was happening was that the 2,200-man Kenya Air Force had decided to overthrow the government at a very strategic and interesting time. For one thing, it was Saturday night, Sunday morning, when most government offices and things would be closed, when people would be in their homes, when it would be an easier time to take over the country. It was also a time when President Moi was with his army, a 14,500-man Kenya army, far north of Nairobi, so they were out of the city. And it seemed like an ideal time for that coup. It was also the week before the meeting in Tripoli of the Organization of African Unity, where President Moi is this year the chairman of that OAU organization. The events that transpired throughout Sunday and into Monday were indeed frightening, and I'm grateful to God that he preserved us from personally witnessing many of them. As we left the airport later that week, we got into conversation with an employee of World Vision who is from here in the Twin Cities. She now lives out in Monrovia, California. And she told how she was planning to get a flight out to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on Sunday morning, went down to check out of her hotel and wanted to catch a taxi cab out to the airport. As she looked out for a taxi cab, she saw one and tried to get it, but it was stopped by the soldiers. It was a taxi cab driver and a woman passenger, and there were soldiers on both sides that questioned him, and she doesn't know what was said, but apparently something was said that they didn't like and didn't appreciate. And the soldiers then fired their automatic weapons into both sides of that taxi cab. It was then a few minutes later that the taxi cab driver came into her hotel, wounded in the shoulder and bleeding, but not severely wounded, and explained that the woman passenger out in the car had been shot severely and was bleeding severely, and pleaded with someone to go out and help her. I don't know what you would do under those circumstances, but no one in the hotel was willing to go out and help her. As a result, she bled to death out in that cab. In the city center of Nairobi was where most of the difficulty and most of the problems occurred. There are many shops there, most of them owned and operated by Asians who live in Kenya, and many of them in the downstairs area of the Hilton Hotel. And that became really the hub for where the work...